That evening, when the road across the Windsor Dam is closed, the escort is found abandoned in the picnic area at Goodenough Dyke. When the car is still there the next morning, two Water Authority guys, who knows, perhaps Lorington was one of them, and two Forest Service rangers start looking for her. 2 miles up East Street, they find her shoes. 2 miles farther up, where East Street goes to dirt, it winds through the wilderness on the east shore of the reservoir and is really not a street at all, but a Massachusetts version of the deep cut road, they find her shirt. Uh-oh. 2 miles beyond the abandoned shirt, East Street ends, and a rutty logging stripe, Fitzpatrick Road, leads away from the lake. The searchers are about to go this way when one of them sees something pink hanging from a tree limb down by the water. It proves to be the lady's bra. The ground here is damp, not quite marshy, and they can follow both her tracks and the broken branches through which she is pushed, doing damage that they don't like to think of to her bare skin. Yet the evidence of the damage is there, and they must see it, like it or not. The blood on the branches, and then on the rocks, is part of her trail. 1 mile from where East Street ends, they come to a stone building which stands on an outcropping. It looks across the East Branch at Mount Pomeroy. This building houses Shaft 12 and is accessible by car only from the north. Why Elena or Elina did not just start from the north is a question that will never be answered. The water-bearing aqueduct, which begins at the Quabbin, runs 65 miles dead east to Boston, picking up more water from the Wachusett and Sudbury reservoirs as it goes. The latter two sources are smaller and not quite so pure. There are no pumps. The aqueduct pipe, 13 feet high and 11 feet wide, needs none to do its job. Boston's water supply is provided by simple gravity feed, a technique used by the Egyptians 35 centuries before. 12 vertical shafts run between the ground and the aqueduct. These serve as vents and pressure regulation points. They also serve as points of access should the aqueduct become clogged. Shaft 12, the one closest to the reservoir, is also known as the intake shaft. Water purity is tested there, and female virtue has often been tested there as well. The stone building isn't locked and is a frequent stopping place for lovers in canoes. On the lowest of the 8 steps leading up to the door, they find the woman's jeans, neatly folded. On the top step is a pair of plain white cotton underpants. The door is open. The men look at each other, but no one speaks. They have a good idea of what they're going to find inside. One dead Russian lady hold the clothes. But they don't. The circular iron cover over the top of Shaft 12 has been moved just enough to create a crescent moon of darkness on the reservoir side. Beyond it is the crowbar the woman used to shift the lid. It would have been leaning behind the door where there are a few other tools. And beyond the crowbar is the Russian woman's purse. On top of it is her billfold, open to show her identification card. On top of the billfold, the apex of the pyramid, so to speak, is her passport. Poking out of it is a slip of paper covered with chicken scratches that have to be Russian or Cyrillic, or whatever they call it. The men believe it is a suicide note, but upon translation, it proves to be nothing but the Russian woman's directions. At the very bottom, she has written, "When road ends, walk along shore." And so she did, disrobing as she went, unmindful of the branches which poked and the bushes which scratched. The men stand around the partially covered shaft head, scratching their heads and listening to the babble of the water as it starts on its way to the taps and faucets and fountains and backyard hoses of Boston. The sound is hollow, somehow dank, and there's good reason for that. Shaft 12 is 125 feet deep. The men cannot understand why she chose to do it the way she did, but they can see what she did all too clearly. Can see her sitting on the stone floor with her feet dangling. She looks like a naked version of the girl in the white rock labels. She takes a final look over her shoulder, perhaps to make sure her billfold and her passport are still where she put them. She wants someone to know who passed this way. And there is something hideously, unassuageably sad about that. One look back, and then she slips into the eclipse between the partially dislodged cover and the side of the shaft. Perhaps she held her nose, like a kid cannonballing into the community swimming pool. Perhaps not. Either way, she is gone in less than a second. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Old Mr. Beckwith's final words on the subject before driving on down the road in his mail truck had been these. Way I heard it, the folks in Boston will be drinking her in their morning coffee right around Valentine's Day. Then he'd given Jonesy a grin. I don't drink the water myself. I stick to beer. In Massachusetts, as in Australia, you say that beer. Jonesy had paced around his office 12 or 14 times now. He stopped for a moment behind his desk chair, absently rubbing his hip, then set off again, still counting. Good old obsessive-compulsive Jonesy. 1, 2, 3. The story of the Russian woman was certainly a fine one, a superior example of the small-town creepy yarn, haunted houses where multiple murders had taken place and the sites of terrible roadside accidents were also good, and it certainly cast a clear light on Mr. Gray's plans for Lad, the unfortunate border collie. But what good did it do him to know where Mr. Gray was going? After all, back to the chair again, 48, 49, 50. And wait a minute. Just wait a goddamn minute. The first time he'd gone around the room, he'd done it in just 34 paces, hadn't he? So how could it be 50 this time? He wasn't shuffling, taking baby steps, anything like that. So how? You've been making it bigger. Walking around it and making it bigger. Because you were restless. It's your room, after all. I bet you could make it as big as the Waldorf Astoria ballroom if you wanted to. And Mr. Gray couldn't stop you. Is that possible? Jonesy whispered. He stood by his desk chair, one hand on the back, like a man posing for a portrait. He didn't need an answer to his question. Eyesight was enough. The room was bigger. Henry was coming. If he had Duddits with him, following Mr. Gray would be easy enough, no matter how many times Mr. Gray changed vehicles, because Duddits saw the line. He had led them to Richie Grenadeau in a dream. Later, he had led them to Josie Rinkenhauer in reality. And he could direct Henry now as easily as a keen-nosed hound leads a hunter to the fox's earth. The problem was the lead, the goddamn lead that Mr. Gray had. An hour, at least. Maybe more. And once Mr. Gray had chucked the dog down shaft 12, there went your ball game. There'd be time to shut off Boston's water supply, theoretically, but could Henry convince anyone to take such an enormous disruptive step? Jonesy doubted it. And what about all the people along the way who would drink the water almost immediately? 6,500 in Ware, 11,000 in Athol, over 150,000 in Worcester? Those people would have weeks instead of months, only days in some cases. Was there any way to slow the son of a bitch down? Give Henry a chance to catch up. Jonesy looked up at the dream catcher, and as he did, something in the room changed. There was a sigh, almost, the sort of sound ghosts are reputed to make at seances. But this was no ghost, and Jonesy felt his arms prickle. At the same time, his eyes filled with tears. A line from Thomas Wolfe occurred to him. Oh, lost, a stone, a leaf, an unfound door. Thomas Wolfe, whose thesis had been that you can't go home again. Duddits, he whispered. The hair on his neck had stiffened. Duddy, is that you? No answer. But when he looked at the desk where the useless phone had stood, he saw that something new had been added. Not a stone or a leaf, not an unfound door, but a cribbage board and a deck of cards. Someone wanted to play the game. Hurt pretty much all the time now. Mama know. He tell Mama. Jesus know. He tell Jesus. He don't tell Henry. Henry hurts too. Henry tired and make sad. Beaver and Pete are in heaven where they sitteth at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth forever and ever. Jesus sake, amen. That makes him sad. They were good friends and played games, but never made fun. Once they found Josie, and once they saw a tall guy, he a cowboy, and once they play the game. This a game, too, Only Pete used to say, "Duddits, it doesn't matter if you win or booze, it's how you play the game." Only this time it does matter. It does. Jonesy say it does. Jonesy hard of hearing, but pretty soon it'll be better. Pretty soon. If only he don't hurt. Even his perco don't help. His throat makes sore, and his body shakes, and his belly make hurty, kind of like when he has to go poo-poo, kind of like that. But he doesn't have to go poo-poo, and when he coughs, sometimes make blood. He would like to sleep, but there is Henry and his new friend, Owen, that was there the day they found Josie, and they say, "If only we could slow him down, if only we could catch up," and he has to stay awake and help them. But he has to close his eyes to hear Jonesy, and they think he's asleep. Owen says, "Shouldn't we wake him up? What if the son of a bitch turns off somewhere?" And Henry says, "I tell you, I know where he's going, but we'll wake him up at I-90 just to be sure. For now, let him sleep. My God, he looks so tired." And again, only this time thinking it, "If only we could slow the son of a bitch down." Eyes closed. Arms crossed over his aching chest, breathing slow. Mama say, "Breathe slow when you cough." Jonesy's not dead, not in heaven with Beaver and Pete. But Mr. Gray say Jonesy locked, and Jonesy believes him. Jonesy's in the office, no phone and no facts. Hard to talk, because Mr. Gray is mean, and Mr. Gray is scared. Scared Jonesy will find out which one is really locked up. When did they talk most? When they played the game. The game. A shudder racks him. He has to make hard think, and it hurts. He can feel it stealing away his strength, the last little bits of his strength. But this time, it's more than just a game. This time, it matters who wins and who boozes. So he gives his strength. He makes the board, and he makes the cards. Jonesy is crying. Jonesy thinks, "Oh, lost." But Duddits Cavell isn't lost. Duddits sees the line. The line goes to the office, and this time he will do more than peg the pegs. "Don't cry, Jonesy," he says. And the words are clear in his mind, as they always are. It is only his stupid mouth that mushes them up. "Don't cry. I'm not lost." Eyes closed, arms crossed. In Jonesy's office, beneath the dreamcatcher, Duddits plays the game. "I've got the dog," Henry said. He sounds exhausted. "The one Perlmutter's homed in on. I've got it. We're a little bit closer. Christ, if there was just a way to slow them down." It was raining now, and Owen could only hope they'd be south of the freeze line if it went over to sleet. The wind was gusting hard enough to sway the Hummer on the road. It was noon, and they were between Saco and Biddeford. Owen glanced into the rearview mirror and saw Duddits in the back seat, eyes closed, head back, skinny arms crossed on his chest. His complexion was an alarming yellow, but a thin line of bright blood trickled from the corner of his mouth. "Is there any way your friend can help?" Owen asked. "I think he's trying." "I thought you said he was asleep." Henry turned, looked at Duddits, then at Owen. "I was wrong," he said. Jonesy dealt the cards, threw two into the crib from his hand, then picked up the other hand and added two more. "Don't cry, Jonesy. Don't cry. I'm not lost." Jonesy glanced up at the dreamcatcher, quite sure that the words had come from there. "I'm not crying, Duds. Fucking allergies, that's all. Now I think you want to play." "Two," said the voice from the dreamcatcher. Jonesy played the deuce from Duddits' hand. Not a bad lead, actually. Then played a seven from his own. That made nine. Duddits had a six in his hand. The question was whether or not... "Six for 15," said the voice from the dreamcatcher. 15 for two. Kiss my bender." Jonesy laughed in spite of himself. It was Duddits, all right. But for a moment he had sounded just like the beeve. "Go on and peg it, then." And watched, fascinated, as one of the pegs in the board rose, floated, and settled back down in the second hole on First Street. Suddenly he understood something. You could play all along, couldn't you, Duds? You used to peg all crazy just because it made us laugh. The idea brought fresh tears to his eyes. All those years that they'd thought they were playing with Duddits, he had been playing with them. And on that day behind Tracker Brothers, who had found whom? Who had saved whom? 21, he said. 31 for 2. From the Dreamcatcher. And once again the unseen hand lifted the peg and played it 2 holes farther on. He's blocked to me, Jonesy. I know. Jonesy played a 3. Duddits called 13, and Jonesy played it out of Duddits's hand. But you're not. You can talk to him. Jonesy played his own deuce and pegged 2. Duddits played, pegged 1 for the last card, and Jonesy thought, outpegged by a retard, what do you know? Except this Duddits wasn't retarded. Exhausted and dying, but not retarded. They pegged their hands, and Duddits was far ahead, even though it had been Jonesy's crib. Jonesy swept the cards together and began to shuffle them. What does he want, Jonesy? What does he want besides water? Murder, Jonesy thought. He likes to kill people. But no more of that. Please God, no more of that. Bacon, he said. He does like bacon. He began to shuffle the cards, then froze as Duddits filled his mind. The real Duddits, young and strong and ready to fight. Behind them, in the back seat, Duddits groaned loudly. Henry turned and saw fresh blood, red as virus, running from his nostrils. His face was twisted in a terrible cramp of concentration. Beneath their closed lids, his eyeballs rolled rapidly back and forth. "What's the matter with him?" Owen asked. "I don't know." Duddits began to cough, deep and racking bronchial sounds. Blood flew from between his lips in a fine spray. "Wake him up, Henry, for Christ's sake, wake him up!" Henry gave Owen Underhill a frightened look. They were approaching Kennebunkport now, no more than 20 miles from the New Hampshire border, 110 from the Quabbin Reservoir. Jonesy had a picture of the Quabbin on the wall of his office. Henry had seen it, and a cottage nearby in Ware. Duddits cried out, a single word repeated 3 times between bursts of coughing. The sprays of blood weren't heavy, not yet. The stuff was coming from his mouth and throat, but if his lungs began to rupture... "Wake him up! He says he's aching. Can't you hear him?" "He's not saying aching." "What then? What?" "He's saying bacon." The entity, which now thought of itself as Mr. Gray, who thought of himself as Mr. Gray, had a serious problem, but at least he knew it. "Forewarned is forearmed," is how Jonesy put it. There were hundreds of such sayings in Jonesy's storage cartons, perhaps thousands. Some of them Mr. Gray found utterly incomprehensible. A nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse was one such. What goes around comes around was another. But forewarned is forearmed was a good one. His problem could be best summed up with how he felt about Jonesy. And, of course, that he felt at all was bad enough. He could think, now Jonesy is cut off, and I have solved my problem. I have quarantined him just as their military tried to quarantine us. I am being followed, chased in fact, but barring engine trouble or a flat tire, neither group of followers has much chance of catching me. I have too great a lead. These things were facts. Truth. But they had no savor. What had savor was the idea of going to the door behind which his reluctant host was imprisoned and yelling, "I fixed you, didn't I? I fixed your little red wagon, didn't I?" What a wagon, red or otherwise, had to do with any of this, Mr. Gray didn't know. But it was an emotional bullet of fairly high caliber from Jonesy's armory. It had a deep and satisfying childhood resonance. And then he would stick Jonesy's tongue. "My tongue now," Mr. Gray thought with undeniable satisfaction, between Jonesy's lips, and give him the old raspberry. As for the followers, he wanted to drop Jonesy's pants and show them Jonesy's buttocks. This was as senseless as what goes around comes around, as senseless as Little Red Wagon, but he wanted to do it. It was called Mooning the Assholes, and he wanted to do it. He was, Mr. Gray realized, infected with this world's virus. It began with emotion, progressed to sensory awareness, the taste of food, the undeniable savage pleasure of making the state trooper beat his head in against the tiled bathroom wall, the hollow thud thud of it, and then progressed to what Jonesy called higher thinking. This was a joke in Mr. Gray's view, not much different from calling shit reprocessed food or genocide ethnic cleansing. And yet, thinking had its attractions for a being which had always existed as part of a vegetative mind, a sort of highly intelligent not-consciousness. Before Mr. Gray had shut him up, Jonesy had suggested that he give over his mission and simply enjoy being human. Now he discovered that desire in himself, as his previously harmonious mind, his not-conscious mind, began to fragment, to turn into a crowd of opposing voices, some wanting A, some wanting B, some wanting Q squared and divided by Z. He would have thought such babble would be horrible, the stuff of madness. Instead, he found himself enjoying the wrangle. There was bacon. There was sex with Carla, which Jonesy's mind identified as a superlatively enjoyable act, involving both sensory and emotional input. There was fast driving and bumper pool in O'Leary's bar near Fenway Park, and beer, and live bands that played loud, and Patti Loveless singing Blame It on Your Lying, Cheating, Cold, Dead, Beaten, Two-Timing, Double-Dealing, Mean, Mistreating, Loving Heart, whatever that meant. There was the look of the land rising from the fog on a summer morning. And murder, of course. There was that. His problem was that if he didn't finish this business quickly, he might never finish it at all. He was no longer Byram, but Mr. Gray. How long before he left Mr. Gray behind and became Jonesy? It's not going to happen, he thought. He pressed the accelerator down, and although it didn't have much, the Subaru gave him a little more. In the back seat, the dog yipped, then howled in pain. Mr. Gray sent out his mind and touched the Byram growing inside the dog. It was growing fast, almost too fast. And here was something else. There was no pleasure in meeting its mind, none of the warmth that comes when like encounters like. The mind of the Byram felt cold, rancid, alien, he muttered. Nevertheless, he quieted it. When the dog went into the water supply, the Byram should still be inside. It would need time to adapt. The dog would drown. But the Byram would live yet a while, feeding on the dog's dead body until it was time. But first, he had to get there. It wouldn't be long now. As he drove west on I-90, past little towns, shit splats, Jonesy thought of them, but not without affection, like Westboro, Grafton, and Dorothy Pond, getting closer now, maybe 40 miles to go, he looked for a place to put his new and uneasy consciousness where it wouldn't get him in trouble. He tried Jonesy's kids, then backed away, far too emotional. Tried Duddits again, but that was still a blank. Jonesy had stolen the memories. Finally, he settled on Jonesy's work, which was teaching history, and his specialty, which was gruesomely fascinating. Between 1860 and 1865, it seemed, America had split in two, as virus colonies did near the end of each growth cycle. There had been all sorts of causes, the chief of which had to do with slavery. But again, this was like calling shit or vomit reprocessed food. Slavery meant nothing. Right of secession meant nothing. Preserving the Union meant nothing. Basically, they had just done what these creatures did best. They got mad, which was really the same thing as going mad, but more socially acceptable. Oh, but on such a scale. Mr. Gray was investigating boxes and boxes of fascinating weaponry, grape shot, chain shot, mini balls, cannon balls, bayonets, landmines, when a voice intruded. Bacon. He pushed the thought aside, although Jonesy's stomach gurgled. He'd like some bacon, yes. Bacon was fleshy and greasy and slippery and satisfying in a primitive physical way, but this was not the time. Perhaps after he'd gotten rid of the dog. Then, if he had time before the others caught up, he could eat himself to death if he so chose. But this was not the time. As he passed exit 10, only two to go now, he turned his mind back to the Civil War, to blue men and gray men running through the smoke, screaming and stabbing each other in the guts, fixing little red wagons without number, pounding the stocks of their rifles into the skulls of their enemies, producing those intoxicating thud, thud sounds, and bacon. His stomach gurgled again. Saliva squirted into Jonesy's mouth, and he remembered Dysart's. The brown and crispy strips on the blue plate, you picked it up with your fingers. The texture was hard, the texture of dead and tasty flesh. Can't think of this. A horn honked irritably, making Mr. Gray jump, making Lad whine. He had wandered into the wrong lane, what Jonesy's mind identified as the passing lane, and he pulled over to let one of the big trucks, going faster than the Subaru could go, sweep by. It splashed the small car's windshield with muddy water, momentarily blinding him, and Mr. Gray thought, "Catch you, kill you, beat the brains out of your head, you unsafe Johnny Reb of a driver, you thud, thud, fix your wagon, your little red bacon sandwich." That one was like a gunshot in his head. He fought it, but the strength of it was something entirely new. Could that be Jonesy? Surely not, Jonesy wasn't that strong. But suddenly he seemed all stomach, and the stomach was hollow, hurting, craving. Surely he could stop long enough to assuage it. If he didn't, he was apt to drive right off the bacon sandwich with mayo. Mr. Gray let out an inarticulate cry, unaware that he'd begun to drool helplessly. "I hear him," Henry said suddenly. He put his fists to his temples as if to contain a headache. "Christ, it hurts. He's so hungry." "Who?" Owen asked. They had just crossed the state line into Massachusetts. In front of the car, the rain fell in silver, wind-slanted lines. "The dog? Jonesy? Who?" "Him," Henry said. "Mr. Gray." He looked at Owen, a sudden wild hope in his eye. "I think he's pulling over. I think he's stopping." "Boss." Kurtz was on the verge of dozing again when Perlmutter turned, not without effort, and spoke to him. They had just gone through the New Hampshire tolls, Freddie Johnson being careful to use the automated exact change lane. He was afraid a human toll taker might notice the stench in the Humvee's cabin, the broken window in back, the weaponry, or all three. Kurtz looked into Archie Perlmutter's sweat-streaked, haggard face with interest, with fascination even. The colorless, bean-counting bureaucrat, he of the briefcase on station and clipboard in the field, hair always neatly combed and parted ruler straight on the left, the man who could not for the life of him train himself out of using the word sir, that man was gone. Thin though it was, he thought Pearlie's countenance had somehow richened. "He's turning into Ma Jode," Kurtz thought, and almost giggled.
"Boss, I'm still thirsty."
Pearlie cast longing eyes on Kurtz's Pepsi, then blew out another hideous fart. "Ma Jode on trumpet in hell," Kurtz thought, and this time he did giggle. Freddie cursed, but not with his former shocked disgust. Now he sounded resigned, almost bored.
"I'm afraid this is mine, Buck," Kurtz said, "and I'm a wee parched myself."
Perlmutter began to speak, then winced as a fresh pain struck him. He farted again, the sound thinner this time, not a trumpet, but an untalented child blowing over a piccolo. His eyes narrowed, became crafty.
"Give me a drink, and I'll tell you something you want to know."
A pause.
"Something you need to know."
Kurtz considered. Rain slapped the side of the car and came in through the busted window. The goddamn window was a pain in the ass, praise Jesus. The arm of his jacket was soaked right through, but he would have to bear up. Who was responsible, after all?
You are,
Pearlie said, and Kurtz jumped. The mind-reading thing was just so spooky. You thought you were getting used to it, and then realized that no, negative, you were not.
You're responsible. So give me a fucking drink. Boss?
Watch your mouth, cheese boy, Freddy rumbled.
Tell me what you know, and you can have the rest of this.
Kurtz raised the Pepsi bottle, waggling it in front of Pearlie's tortured gaze. Kurtz was not without humorous self-loathing as he did this. Once he had commanded whole units and had used them to alter entire geopolitical landscapes. Now his command was two men and a soft drink. He had fallen low. Pride had brought him low, praise God. He had the pride of Satan, and if it was a fault, it was a hard one to give up. Pride was the belt you could use to hold up your pants even after your pants were gone. Do you promise? Pearlie's red, fuzzed tongue came out and licked at his parched lips.
If I'm lying, I'm dying, Kurtz said solemnly. Hell, Buck, read my fucking mind.
Pearlie studied him for a moment, and Kurtz could almost feel the man's creepy little fingers, mats of red stuff now growing under each nail in his head. An awful sensation, but he bore it. At last, Perlmutter seemed satisfied. He nodded.
I'm getting more now, he said.
And then his voice lowered to a confidential, horrified whisper.
It's eating me, you know. It's eating my guts. I can feel it.
Kurtz patted him on the arm. Just now they were passing a sign which read, Welcome to Massachusetts.
I'm going to take care of you, laddie buck. I promised, didn't I? Meantime, tell me what you're getting. Mr. Gray is stopping. He's hungry.
Kurtz had left his hand on Perlmutter's arm. Now he tightened his grip, turning his fingernails into talons.
Where? Close to where he's going. It's a store.
In a chanting, childish voice that made Kurtz's skin crawl, Archie Perlmutter said,
Best bait, why wait? Best bait, why wait?
Then resuming a more normal tone,
Jonesy knows Henry and Owen and Duddits are coming. That's why he made Mr. Gray stop.
The idea of Owen catching Jonesy, Mr. Gray, filled Kurtz with panic.
Archie, listen to me carefully. I'm thirsty,
Perlmutter whined.
I'm thirsty, you son of a bitch!
Kurtz held the Pepsi bottle up in front of Perlmutter's eyes, then slapped away Perlmutter's hand when Pearlie reached for it.
Do Henry, Owen, and Dud Dutz know Jonesy and Mr. Gray have stopped? Dud Dits, you old fool,
Perlmutter snarled, then groaned with pain and clutched at his stomach, which was on the rise again.
Dits! Dits! Dud Dits! Yes, they know. Duddits helped to make Mr. Gray hungry. He and Jonesy did it together.
I don't like this, Freddy said.
Join the club, Kurtz thought.
Please, boss, Pearlie said. I'm so thirsty.
Kurtz gave him the bottle, watched with a jaundiced eye as Perlmutter drained it.
$4.95, boss, Freddy announced. What do I do?
Take it, Perlmutter said. Then 90 West.
He burped. It was loud, but blessedly odorless.
It wants another Pepsi. It likes the sugar. Also the caffeine.
Kurtz pondered. Owen knew their quarry had stopped, at least temporarily. Now Owen and Henry would sprint, trying to make up as much of that 90 to 100-minute lag as they could. Consequently, they must sprint as well. Any cops who got in their way would have to die, God bless them. One way or the other, this was coming to a head.
Freddy?
Boss?
Pedal to the metal. Make this bitch strut, God love you. Make her strut.
Freddy Johnson did as ordered. There was no barn, no corral, no paddock, and instead of out-of-state LICs, the sign in the window showed a photograph of the Quabbin Reservoir over the legend, "Best Bait, Why Wait?" But otherwise, the little store could have been Goslin's all over again. Same ratty siding, same mud-brown shingles, same crooked chimney dribbling smoke into the rainy sky, same rusty gas pump out front. Another sign leaned against the pump, this one reading, "No gas. Blame the ragheads." On that early afternoon in November, the store was empty save for the proprietor, a gentleman named Deke McCaskill. Like most other folks, he had spent the morning glued to the TV. All the coverage, repetitive stuff for the most part, and with that part of the North Woods cordoned off, no good pictures of anything but Army, Navy, and Air Force hardware, had led up to the president's speech. Deke called the president Mr. Okefenokee, on account of the fucked-up way he'd been elected. Couldn't anybody down there fucking count? Although he had not exercised his own option to vote since the Gipper, now there had been a president, Deke hated President Okefenokee. Thought he was an oily, untrustworthy motherfucker with big teeth, good-looking wife, though. And he thought the president's 11 o'clock speech had been the usual blah-de-blah. Deke didn't believe a word old Okefenokee said. In his view, the whole thing was probably a hoax. Scare tactics calculated to make the American taxpayer more willing to hike defense spending and thus taxes. There was nobody out there in space. Science had proved it. The only aliens in America, except for President Okefenokee himself, that was, were the Beaners who swam across the border from Mexico. But people were scared, sitting home and watching TV. A few would be in later for beer or bottles of wine, but for now, the place was as dead as a cat run over on the highway. Deke had turned off the TV half an hour ago. Enough was enough, by the Christ. And when the bell over his door jangled at 1:15, he was studying a magazine from the rack at the back of the store, where a sign proclaimed B-21 or Be Gone. This particular periodical was titled Lasses in Glasses. A fair title, since all the lasses within were wearing spectacles. Nothing else, but glasses, see. He looked up at the newcomer, started to say something like, "How you doing?" or "Road's getting slippery yet?" and then didn't. He felt a bolt of unease, followed by a sudden certainty that he was going to be robbed. And if robbery was all, he'd be off lucky. He never had been robbed, not in the 12 years he'd owned the place. If a fellow wanted to risk prison for a handful of cash, there were places in the area where bigger handfuls could be had. A guy would have to be... Deke swallowed. A guy would have to be crazy, he'd been thinking. And maybe this guy was. Maybe he was one of those maniacs who'd just offed his whole family and then decided to ramble around a bit, kill a few more folks before turning one of his guns on himself. Deke wasn't paranoid by nature. He was lumpish by nature, his ex-wife would have told you, but that didn't change the fact that he felt suddenly menaced by the afternoon's first customer. He didn't care very much for the fellows who sometimes turned up and loafed around the store, talking about the Patriots or the Red Sox or telling stories about the whoppers they'd caught up to the reservoir, but he wished for a few of them now, a whole gang of them, actually. The man just stood there, inside the door at first. And yeah, there was something wrong with him. He was wearing an orange hunting coat, and deer season hadn't started yet in Massachusetts, but that could have been nothing. What Deke didn't like were the scratches on the man's face, as if he had spent at least some of the last couple of days going cross-country through the woods, and the haunted, drawn quality of the features themselves. His mouth was moving as though he was talking to himself. Something else, too. The gray afternoon light slanting in through the dusty front window glinted oddly on his lips and chin. "That son of a bitch is drooling," Deke thought. "Be goddamned if he ain't." The newcomer's head snapped around in quick little ticks while his body remained perfectly still, reminding Deke of the way an owl remains perfectly still on its branch as it looks for prey. Deke thought briefly of sliding out of his chair and hiding under the counter, but before he could do more than begin to consider the pros and cons of such a move, Not a particularly quick thinker, his ex-wife would have told you that as well. The guy's head did another of those quick flicks and was pointing right at him. The rational part of Deke's mind had been harboring the hope, it was not quite an articulated idea, that he was imagining the whole thing, just suffering the whim-whams from all the weird news and weirder rumors, each dutifully reported by the press, coming out of northern Maine. Maybe this was just a guy who wanted smokes or a six-pack, or maybe a bottle of coffee brandy and a stroke book, something to get him through the long, sleety night in a motel outside of Ware or Belchertown. That hope died when the man's eyes met his. It wasn't the gaze of a family-murdering maniac off on his own private cruise to nowhere. It almost would have been better if that had been the case. The newcomer's eyes, far from empty, were too full. A million thoughts and ideas seemed to be crossing them, like one of those big-city ticker tapes being run at super speed. They seemed almost to be hopping in their sockets. And they were the hungriest eyes Deke McCaskill had seen in his entire life. "We're closed," Deke said. The words came out in a croak that didn't sound like his voice at all.
"Me and my partner, he's in the back. We closed for the day. On account of the goings-on up north, just forgot to flip over the sign.
He might have run on for hours, days even, but the man in the hunting coat interrupted him.
"Bacon," he said. "Where is it?"
Deke knew, suddenly and absolutely, that if he didn't have bacon, this man would kill him. He might kill him anyway, but without bacon, yes, certainly. He did have bacon. Thank God, thank Christ, thank Okie Fanokie and all the hopping ragheads, he did have bacon.
"Cooler in back," he said in his new, strange voice.
The hand, lying on top of his magazine, felt as cold as a block of ice. In his head, he heard whispering voices that didn't seem to be his own. Red thoughts and black thoughts. Hungry thoughts. An inhuman voice asked, "What's a cooler?" A tired voice, very human, responded,
"Go on up the aisle, handsome. You'll see it."
Hearing voices, Deke thought.
Oh, Jesus, no, that's what happens to people just before they flip out.
The man moved past Deke and up the center aisle. He walked with a heavy limp. There was a phone by the cash register. Deke looked at it, then looked away. It was within reach, and he had 911 on the speed dialer, but it might as well have been on the moon. Even if he was able to summon enough strength to reach for the phone.
"I'll know," the inhuman voice said,
and Deke let out a breathless little moan. It was inside his head, as if someone had planted a radio in his brain. There was a convex mirror mounted over the door, a gadget that came in especially handy in the summer when the store was full of kids headed up to the reservoir with their parents. The Quabbin was only 18 miles from here, for fishing or camping or just a picnic. Little bastards were always trying to kite stuff, particularly the candy and the girly magazines. Now Deke looked into it, watching with dread fascination as the man in the orange coat approached the cooler. He stood there a moment, gazing in, then grabbed not just one package of bacon, but all four of them. The man came back down the middle aisle with the bacon, limping along and scanning the shelves. He looked dangerous. He looked hungry, and he also looked dreadfully tired, like a marathon runner going into the last mile. Looking at him gave Deke the same sense of vertigo he felt when he looked down from a high place. It was like looking not at one person, but at several, overlaid and shifting in and out of focus. Deke thought fleetingly of a movie he'd seen, some daffy cunt with about 100 personalities. The man stopped and got a jar of mayonnaise. At the foot of the aisle, he stopped again and snagged a loaf of bread. Then he was at the counter again. Deke could almost smell the exhaustion coming out of his pores and the craziness. He set his purchases down and said, Bacon sandwiches on white with mayo, those are the best. And smiled. It was a smile of such tired, heartbreaking sincerity that Deke forgot his fear for a moment. Without thinking, he reached out. Mister, are you all right? Deke's hand stopped, as if it had run into a wall. It trembled for a moment over the counter, then flew up and slapped his own face. Crack!